talking about everybody getting crunk, crunk. Boys try to touch my junk, junk. Gonna smack him if he getting too drunk, drunk. Nah, nah, we go until they kick us out, out. The police shut us down, down. Police shut us down, down. Po-po shut us down, down.
Chapter 2. It's a big party. The equestrian whatever. The Amstrian Society of Horse Fuckers, or whatever, has a whole old pre-reform manor on the university grounds where all the stables and sports fields are. And the horse club kids get to live there as dorm housing because they need to be close to establish a telepathic dream commune with the animals or something. Ed grew up too close to working barns to see the appeal. But the point is that the horse people tend to host the big parties. Big enough to have their own parking lot. Which, okay, is probably for the horse trailers. But lets the biker guys park them all in quite nicely. Hay and horse shit wafts over the path walking up to the house. But stepping through the open door is like being hit with a wall of sugar booze, sweet tobacco, and perfume. The first thing Ed sees is that someone has clearly stolen one of the public loudspeaker systems off the light poles on the promenade and reinstalled it in the entry hall, which explains where the music is pumping from. There are cables all over the floor and bare wires sticking out from a repurposed broomstick in between patches of tape and a scattering of alligator clips. This completes what looks to be a gruesome marriage between a radio and a record player, which, of course, means that they lose Winry immediately. "Who did this?" she breathes, and they're close enough to the group clustered around the wires that a guy with a broad, inebriated grin turns and raises both arms in an even broader victory. "That's all Brett, yo!" someone yells, and a cheer goes up as the guy is subsumed under a round of backslaps. Winry descends on him with her eyes wide in an expression to send sane man for the nearest drink. So Ed heads off to do exactly that. He changes course only slightly when he sees what he thinks is Landy, but turns out to be some other girl entirely, holding a violently fuzzy golden puppy in her arms. This immediately takes May, because while Xiaomei is too big now to go traveling in her pockets, the essential lure of exotic purse dogs is embedded too deep to erase. May teleports instantly to the girl's side, Al ambling after, and pretty soon all the cooing and petting over the puff turns into cooing over May's accent and hair and, "Oh my god, you're from Xing? Like, Xing, Xing? That's so cool, what's it like there?" May eats that shit up with a shovel, so this leaves Ed with the med students and the bikers. This is a little like being in that river wolf rabbit cabbage problem, only the wolves have all swum off by themselves and left Ed with 20 rabbits and 15 cabbages. The bikers are all looking around with interest, at least, while the med students are mostly clustered up and looking both extremely hungry and deeply unprepared to do anything about it. Ed briefly considers fucking off and letting nature take its course, but that'd probably violate some law of party hospitality. And in any case, if 20 minutes riding bitch is enough to ignite this kind of high-speed sexual crisis, they deserve some kind of intervention. "Y'all need some alcohol," he decides benevolently. "Come on, this way." The drinks table is more or less the entire kitchen, and they've arrived early enough that it only looks a little bit like a locust plague came through. Ed leaves his cabbage rabbit convoy to sort themselves out and heads straight for the Samagon. Only then he sees somebody's brought a whole tub of pear compote and abandons the vodka to ladle himself a full glass of that instead. Al turns up at his shoulder as he's hunting for a spoon, mixing together something that Ed can tell at a glance is for May. "Yo, cough up the child support," Ed says, nodding at the kids pouring themselves drinks, like it's baby's first brain surgery on the other end of the long table. one of the weedier ones, sporting a strict side part, passes the tonic water to a bike guy with a neck tattoo, breathless lust so embarrassingly vivid all over his face that Ed can only shake his head. Are they even allowed out unsupervised? It'll be good for them, Al says mildly, stirring. Yeah, but like, when you turn guppies loose, you drop them into the kiddie pool, not the piranha tank, Ed says. Look at them. They ain't even got water wings. They showed up here sober. So did you, Al says, unperturbed. I'm not their mother. Yeah, but look at them, Ed says, and would elaborate further, only someone on the other end of the kitchen says, I can't believe they stuck Dr. Lovelace with a zine. And Ed and Al both swivel in that direction as if magnetized. Diagnosis Critical is, objectively, a terrible show. The whole premise is that there's a team of alchemists and doctors that travel all around Amstress to various crises using incredibly fake medical alchemy to treat everything from gleefully gory train crashes, always caused by Erugan saboteurs or Ishvalan sympathizers, to completely made-up diseases, always contracted, of course, on ill-advised trips abroad. This is all in between love triangles, drug abuse, secret marriages, and long-lost twins, and you can't go 5 minutes without discovering some character's third or fourth dark, dramatic, vast mega-secret. Ed and Al have the radio on every Tuesday, 8 p.m. on the dot. It's so popular, some central production studio made a movie out of it last spring. Ed and Al hit the theater thrice, each time assuring the other that it was only because Avine Ain was playing Dr. Marie Hollow and wore dresses under her white coat that were probably a stoning offense in Arugo. It's also pretty fucking obvious alchemy propaganda. As one of the most popular shows in the cohort that got boosted right after The Promised Day, all but rolled out by the Ministry of Culture itself in order to mitigate some of the serious public pissiness a statewide alchemical disaster causes. Ed feels he and Al are not qualified to voice an opinion on that broader subject, mostly because they spend at least an hour after every episode ranting about every single alchemy inaccuracy, inconsistency, and impossibility, and also how Azine and Dr. Lovelace are totally fucking wrong for each other. Everyone here agrees about that, at least, even if half the kids are convinced it should have been Dr. Avelle instead of Marie. You're just saying that because they switched the voice actor, some girl with a bob cut accuses the most vocal of the Avelle faction. We all know you have a crush on that soldier show, motherfucker. Eastern Justice is not a soldier show. It's about a private detective. Ed knows what the guy's talking about, even if he hadn't realized the voice actor changed off Eastern Justice. Because Avelle is boring and stiff and has such a high opinion of himself that he doesn't even bother checking his patients' records to see if there's any chance of his cutting-edge treatments interacting with their homebrew remedies and turning them into a vegetable. Unlike Marie, Eastern Justice is actually a good show, too. Good enough to have, like, 5 different run-ins with the censors in the past 2 years alone, managing to stay on air through a combination of massive popularity and the writers towing the line by having all the undesirable characters die horribly slash rightfully by the end of the arc. Which is more or less why Al doesn't like it, which is why Ed doesn't really listen to it much anymore. Not unless it's already on somewhere at a cafe or in the university common rooms or whatever. The talk turns more fully to dissecting Justice's latest plotline, and Al toasts Ed with his drink, wiggles Maze in an explanatory way, and slips off. Ed's all set to follow him, Only they'd migrated to opposite sides of the group, and right then the girl immediately to Ed's right says, "I can't fucking believe they called the WEPO depot the Western Bank Police Deputy Commissioner's Plaza." And like hell can Ed leave a tiny, insane, crazy regionalism nitpick alone. His accent has smoothed enough that he mostly really does sound City East. And he knows the metro area well enough to join forces with a couple of other East-voiced girls and rant expansively about how stupid the whole Mystery Drownings plotline was and how you could tell when the writing team was swapped around because those episodes always went from street-level knowledge. "The fried chickpea vendor," Ed yells, half-overlapping with the buck-toothed girls, "on Plaza 4! To completely fucking forgetting that East is built on a river. There is no secondary garrison detachment in the city. All the outposts outside the main base are outside city limits," the bucktooth girl concludes disgustedly. "There's a whole barracks complex and munitions dump that got built during the Civil War. It's still in use. That's where the main freight yards are. You can fucking tell that writers come from Central." That and how none of them will touch the whole aftermath in the East plot line, a guy with double braids says. Though maybe just because Central writers cost more and they have no budget left over for the soundscape stuff. I heard making all those group scenes and all the alchemy sound effects is expensive. As if anybody's even touched anything close to that kind of story, ever since Mustang got appointed, snorts a guy with square glasses. Because talking about Eastern justice leads to talking about politics, leads immediately to talking about Mustang. Of course. Everybody's too chicken shit to try it until someone else does it first and they can see how he'll jump. And nobody's gonna be raring to go first anytime soon. Another kid with an actual tie says sardonically. Ed glances around. As the conversation turned from diagnosis critical, the group demographics similarly shifted into worse haircuts and stiffer outfits. Law, maybe? Poli-sci? "Why wait for a censorship crackdown? The Steel Corp trial is next week." The Steel Corp trial. Ed has to hold in a groan. The initial farce of some moron trying to kill Mustang has spun out into a whole big thing. And now that the trial is coming up, the papers and the radio won't fucking shut up about it again. Ed cannot fucking believe that the bastard has managed to turn pet sitting into a national fucking conversation. Even if he has, officially, said no comment to any question regarding the rumors of him keeping mammoth snake chimeras and thus ensured that everyone in the country thinks his house is infested with them. Sure, that's one way to no-cost up security. But at some point, the rumors go from fucking funny as hell to just another barb in the sharkskin suit of Mustang's reputation. And it's so fucking weird hearing people talk about Mustang. Extremely funny sometimes, but mostly just surreal. Ed realized recently that keeping his fucking mouth shut whenever Mustang comes up has given him a reputation as apolitical of all things. Just because he knows that if he opines in any way on the subject, it'll out him immediately as someone who spent way too much fucking time in direct contact with the bastard. Al thinks this is the funniest fucking thing in the world, of course, and expresses this mostly by sipping on whatever's in his glass and making hard eye contact like he can transcribe the diatribe running through Ed's head down to the expletives. This, at least, keeps the monologues internal. Because, hey, Al pretty much can hear it. Which is basically like getting to say it aloud anyway. But Al's off with May right now, so Ed just has to really concentrate on fishing the slippery bits of fruit out of his glass and stare with all the vacancy of a gym-haunting meat monster if anybody looks too hard at him, which nobody is, because nobody in this group knows him personally. And in between his fruit cup and the buck-toothed girl's increasingly expansive gestures, he's half obscured from the conversation anyway. I still can't believe it was Mustang, a guy with a quiff and maybe just a comatose ferret up on his head, is saying, of all people, what was Grumman thinking? He was thinking, hey, I'll put up Mustang, he'll follow orders, and we were chess buddies back in East, and now the fucker thinks he can do politics, the buck-toothed girl says disgustedly, folding her arms. That fucking stunt with the budget was just dick-waving, pure and simple. He wouldn't go to the Arugan front. Oh no, but he's the hero of Ishval and wants everyone to remember it. What a cock. It's assholes like him that make everybody think Amstris is full of psychopaths. Ed doesn't know what's funnier. The idea of Mustang sucking dick for promotion or Grumman actually wanting him to. I don't know. They did try to kill him, some other girl says doubtfully. I mean, my dad says he should stick to soldiering too, but like, stick to soldiering? Are you joking? Mustang's with the fucking nationalizers. He's been with them. They got to him probably even before the eclipse. Nobody wants to up and say he's having an affair with Janice because that'll up and fuck you. But everyone can see he's just doing whatever the fuck she tells him. He doesn't give a fuck about the nationalizers. He's just being the same fucking dick-swinging asshole he always was. You heard that whole thing. He went out and did that press conference specifically to make a whole big deal about how he's not satisfied. He just held that because he couldn't not address whether there even was a murder attempt, not with every damn talk show bringing it up. Did you see the cartoon The Sun did? My point is, Fionn, that he'll go after anybody. He's fucking telling people, hey, fuck with me, your whole fucking family gets copped. Okay, hey, no, he had a point though, someone else says. The guy was just a hired gun. He was just doing it for the money. What, you want Mustang to hang the poor idiot who'll take Baron money because there ain't shit else around, but not the actual Baron? And that guy didn't get hung. He took a plea deal and sold everybody out. Like life in a labor camp is better, especially with the Barons now after his head too. And their whole families didn't get copped. My mom's in the same book club as Kvan Marrow, and his wife's the district magistrate. And he said they were waiting for the full seizure orders, but they never came. And no, they didn't just get blackwritten. People seen the families around town, and he said the houses weren't even under guard. That's not the fucking point. Who cares about the gunmen? Mustang probably just set the whole thing up himself, decided he wanted Steel Corp out of the way and gave himself an excuse to go after them and hang them all out to dry. Are you kidding me? Now the whole Steel Belt hates his fucking guts, which is not gonna help him any. And if you think he's such a fucking mastermind, you're telling me that he did that to himself on purpose. Are you kidding me? Those Steel Corp guys screwed everybody over. They tried to assassinate a military officer. Now everybody who's even walked past a Steel Corp building is on a watch list. And both the Justice and War Ministries have grants to shut the whole fucking sector down and seize all the production if they feel like it. They can say they're investigating for collusion, which they have cause for. And if they find so much as a misfiled paper, they can chop off everybody above foreman level, rehire all the factory workers as state employees, and pay them from the same damn funds as before, only now the profit goes straight to the federal treasury. That's what I'm saying. Mustang probably set up the whole thing just for that, and all of that would have happened even if they did kill Mustang, you turnip. The other generals might not like him, but they can't not retaliate, because if they didn't, that sends the message that you can kill a state official and get away with it. You think Mustang set himself up to maybe die just to nationalize the steel industry? No, I'm saying the whole thing was a setup. The hitman and the Steel Corp guys are both patsies. Do you know how many people would love to fuck Mustang over? Almost as many as those who want to fuck Steel Corp. It was probably one of the... It was the Armstrongs. What? Think about it. They own half the mines in Amstress, more than anyone else other than the actual state, and practically the whole family's military. Guess who they sell ore to? That's right. And General Armstrong's never quiet about how much she fucking hates Mustang. What's the skin off her nose to hire a hitman and pin it on Steel Corp? Like Mylan said, they'd have grounds to nationalize production whether Mustang lives or dies, and if he did get killed for her, it's just a bonus. You're saying Armstrong's a nationalizer? She doesn't have to be. That's the point. That whole family plays both sides of the fence on purpose. No matter which way it goes, they still win. It's all rigged. Can we fucking focus? My point is that Mustang's firing shots. No, shut up. I don't care if it was the Armstrongs. Nobody's got any proof. The point is that the nationalizers are making moves, and they've put Mustang up as their masthead. As messages go, it's not subtle. Just fucking watch what happens next. Those poor Steel Corp guys are just the tip of the knife. What is gonna happen to them? Someone asks a little uncertainly. Like, okay, their families haven't been taken in or whatever. What's happening to the guys they did take? They're gonna be executed. Yeah, execution. Attempted murder, state official, military officer. Like Jana said, there's an incentive there for them to slap on everything all the way up to full treason. So, execution. Yeah, I mean, unless Mustang specifically intervenes. Bets on that happening? Laughter all around. Ed lets Bucktooth's girl's hair obscure him completely, sliding him further to the outer edges of the group. He's pretty sure he's the only one here aware that Mustang isn't some cackling cartoon villain. But Ed wouldn't take that bet. Ling had two attempts on his life in the single month Ed spent at the Imperial Court, and both times the assassins were also executed, publicly, after equally public interrogation. Ling's mom, a tiny, plump, salt-and-pepper-haired lady who was always smiling and waving servants over to share snacks, had personally given the orders before the inner city. Ling did not contradict her. In cases such as these, mercy does not only endanger my son, honored princess, Zhiqi Yao said, primarily to Mei, though not so subtly to Ed and Al with her, because they hadn't been able to hide that they weren't exactly thrilled with the results. It risks everyone who protects them. If we do not make an example of those who attempt such bloody acts, if we do not make the risk greater than the potential reward, our people will know we do not defend them. They will know we are happy to throw away their lives and their loyal service for the sake of traitors and criminals. She'd swept her fancy embroidered sleeves out, gesturing at the masked and hooded guards stationed around the rooms. For it is our own beloved retainers who jump in the way of the blade and take the blows meant for us, protecting us with their very lives. Deng Jun, Chao Lan Fan, Chao Xia, Chao Wei, Deng Zhang Min, do we not owe them nothing less than the wholest commitment of our hearts and the fullest extension of our power? Mei had silently bowed. Ed and Al bowed with her. They didn't like it. They understood. Mustang's in that boat, too, now. Kojak and Peters and Anja and Parles, Havoc, Hawkeye, they'll die for him if it comes to it. Ed doesn't have to like it. Though maybe he should kick Mustang's door in and tell him to hurry up and outlaw the death penalty. The fucking firing squad executions, at least. They aren't better than hanging. And labor camps, too, while he's at it. It's not like anything those kids were saying about the hitman is fucking wrong. Besides, what can you fucking expect? Grumman might talk a big game about armistice and alliance with Kreta, but he appointed Mustang to head the war ministry. Someone continues. As Ed wonders whether now is a prudent time to go top up his compote with 100-proof afterburner. Chess buddies or not, even Bradley called Mustang the god of war in those fucking speeches, and Bradley gave us Ishfall, which, incidentally, is where Mustang got all his medals. And he got those by fucking torching little kids. Okay, let's not go pretending the Ishvalans were helpless little babies who just lay there and took it, some other kid says sharply. My whole family had to move east and then to central out of Listenbul because east was getting bombed and Listenbul isn't there anymore. And it wasn't Mustang who did that. Oh my God, can we go one fucking day without talking about Ishfall? Just one day, like one party, that's all I'm asking. Oh, go join the censorship office, Fionn, if you're so fucking hot on that. All I'm saying is don't be surprised if those steel core families do get black written down the line when nobody's paying attention. Because like Mylan said, Jeunesse bringing on Mustang is a fucking message. And in any case, her fucking cartel has the whole justice ministry all sewn up. Ed lets the circle close him out completely. He wants to say, he's not that bad. He wants to say, if you think it's ever someone else running Mustang's show, then you have no fucking clue what's going on. He wants to say, when he fucks up, he owns it. He sets himself to fixing it, and he never stops. He never gives up for a second. He wants to say, he's actually a skinny little twink under that boxy uniform, and he punches like a rabbit. And if he heard you talk all that to his face, he'd smile and eat it all up. And if he thought any of it was particularly good, he'd use it in his next batch of rumors, because it's not about him. He knows it's not about him, and he's going to do what it takes to get the job done. But Ed's not taking himself down that road, and has no business there anyway. It's not his job to defend Mustang. The bastard wouldn't thank him if he did. It's not like there is a defense. Ed may have fucked up, but Mustang fucked up. To own a sin so big, wide as a country, deep as a culture. When Ed thinks about it, his knees have to lock. It's heavier than anything Ed's ever come close to carrying. For all that Mustang's a bastard, he has never once flinched away from the weight. When Ed realized that, he knew that no matter how much he grew, there would always be a part of him that's looking up at Mustang. But thinking about this shit is a fast way to nosedive his own evening. So Ed decides a repeat pilgrimage to the drinks table is in order. And maybe he is apolitical, he thinks sardonically as he sloshes juice into a glass. Not like he can say he's done anything more political in the past 5 years than fuck Ling. And then not fuck Ling. Like, sure, okay, punching the shit out of that fucking father-cloning wannabe god thing on the eclipse probably counts as political enough to ring him up a decent line of credit in that bank, but it's not like that significantly improved things. It just stopped them from getting a lot worse. Now that that's Ed's job, Mustang needs to hurry the fuck up and complete his People I've Got by the Balls collection so that he can really floor the pedal on changing shit. Ed's right arm picks then to do one of its fun little muscle spasms, but thankfully it's small enough and he's quick enough this time that he barely spills anything before he manages to switch hands. He's tempted to be a lot less generous with the juice than the vodka, but being drunk is annoying. And last month at one of Landy's friends' parties, he'd sat down to pee and then spent 10 minutes stuck in the bathroom because he lost the ability to find his underwear inside his pants due to them both being black. This was hilarious, but also a solid barometer of how stupid being yomped makes him. And under these circumstances, A finger of liquor is liable to send him back to those law kids to pick a fight on who the fuck else they think is ready to change shit if Mustang's too much for them to choke down. "Hey, dummy," Wynn says right in Ed's ear, making him yip and jump. "Quit making faces at the drinks and come dance with me." "Wynn, let me drink my drink, fuck!" Ed lets her tow him out of the kitchen, occasionally staggering around people scattered by her like sailboats in a battleship's wake. "Who cares about your drink? You're at a party. You're here to socialize. What happened to Mr. Big Man? Mr. Oh, I have so many friends. You won't be able to move for how many real live friends I'm gonna show you. Hey, I told you. Oh, hey, right here." Ed disengages from Wynn to wave an arm. "Landy! Ed!" Landy goes to them immediately, all smiley and unaware that Ed's about to throw her at Wynn headfirst. He sees it's Al she was talking to. Landy's stepdad breeds Sugar Point cats, so it only took Landy coming over once for her and Al to forge a blood bond unbreakable by time nor force. And he drifts over too, clearly as aware of Winry's inexorable friend lust as Landy isn't. "Hi, Ed," she says happily. "Who's your friend?" "Hi, yeah. Here, this is Winry. Landy, Winry," Ed says, waving a hand between the two of them. "Wynn, Landy did 7 years of ballet with a teacher who had a stristly leg. Landy, Wynn's won the Rush Valley Lindy Hop Flop 3 years in a row." It's not even a full minute before they're marching for the sitting room off the kitchen, doing duty as a makeshift dance floor. Ed loves girls. They're so efficient. "Hey," Al says as Wynn starts gently but firmly pushing the vaguely gyrating drunk kids apart to make herself some room. "May and I are probably going to leave in a little bit with some of my friends." "Huh? What? Are you done?" Ed spins in place, staring at Al, then looking around the room. He can't see any of the guppy squad, but May's pretty clearly waiting by the front hall where they came in. "Where's your kids? Piranhas get them after all?" "No, Eddie C. got a new telescope last week. We're going to go stargazing," Al says. "We were always going to go. It's just we decided we could also come to the party first. There's supposed to be a star shower tonight around 12:45. "What? Where? Fucking nerds?" Ed blurts, as if that doesn't sound interesting as hell and he isn't instantly and all-consumingly jealous. A quick look across the room tells him Wynn is not leaving that fucking dance floor. "How long's it gonna last? Where are you going? Are you gonna come back?" "Eddie has the keys to the atrium roof, so we're gonna go up there," Al says, doubling Ed's envy with one sentence. "He also lives in the grad apartments over on that side of campus, so I was gonna sleep over." "Ugh, okay, go," Ed says, tugging Al in for a hug and then waving him off. "Tell me how it went. Have fun. Don't do anything I wouldn't do." "That's a much longer list than you want people to think it is," Al says, patting his shoulder. "Make good choices." Ed lets him go, watching him pick up a ragged corona of med students, the way that suns catch wayward comets before linking arms with May as they head out. Fuck. Checking out a star shower would be really cool. Maybe he really should put more effort into making Al's friends think he's a little less of a demon. He watches Landy and Winry dance for a bit, laughing as they spin around, pausing occasionally to switch leads or step to the side, demonstrate a bit of footwork. He's smugly pleased to have proved at least one college friend, both extant and worthwhile, to Winry. But doing so has left him down two friends. He could go find McKenna and Brinley and the rest. They're definitely here somewhere. But he doesn't want to drink more, and he doesn't really want to go find a conversation. The only person he'd want to dance with right now is Winry, and she's busy getting flipped over Landy's shoulder in a perfect slingshot aerial. The room is still loud, Ed can tell, but the sound isn't close. The heat of bodies and booze drifted back while he wasn't paying attention. Sensation not quite touching him. Sometimes, if he pauses in the wrong moment, The surreality feeling slips, becoming unreality, becomes a world a little bit too consequence-free. It's not a state he's so far been able to anticipate, avoid, or talk himself out of. After all, he can't lie to himself. He knows what real stakes are, what real choices are. What does it matter whether he goes to school or to parties, takes this class or that one, if he overturns this table, smashes all the drinks on the floor? A little mess, a little fuss, what's it actually going to do? It does matter. He knows that. This is real fucking life. It's just in some moments, some places, he can't feel it. There is a solution, though. Best way to get out of it is to feel something else. And if Al's gone and Wynn's busy, Ed's just gonna have to entertain himself. He steps out of the kitchen side door into the yard, breathing in the warm night air. It's not exactly fresher, because everybody's smoking like chimneys out here. But there's a big, overgrown garden full of aromatic bushes, probably as old as the house itself. And between the shisha and the flowers, it at least doesn't smell like horse shit. There's a skipstone garden path in the muddy grass, leading past a woodpile and some sheds to the backyard. Ed heads down there, only to startle when an irregular shape moves by the wood, almost struggling. Ed nearly whacks it before he realizes that it's just two people making out. And that it's the kid with the side part and the biker he was mooning at. They're clamped around each other like a couple of fighting lampreys, sucking face with all the power of a virgin discovering their first consequence-free hookup. "Jin hun kwai le," Ed mutters under his breath, resisting the urge to clap the kid's shoulder as he edges past. It should cheer him up, and it does, a little. To see the great success of his grand plan of apply alcohol. But mostly it reminds him of all the times Lan Fan and Jun would say it when they found him getting fun with somebody in some corner. Assholes. He needs to mail them something really offensively tackily Amstrian soon. He continues around to the back of the house, letting his metal foot fall a little more heavily out here where it won't ring out of step in the dirt. Relaxing it just enough to feel the drag on his port. An answering ghost echo flickers in his shoulder, reminding him. He hasn't slept up these past years. Shouldn't have dreamed them. Isn't sleepwalking now. The backyard is also full of people, clustered drinking around a fire pit and spread out smoking among the benches and lawn chairs of the back deck. That's where he finds Ponytail, sat with some other biker guys and a couple random kids around a chalion. Perfect. Ponytail's eyes go straight to him, too, which saves time. "Hey," Ed greets him, holding the eye contact as he takes a sustained sip of his drunk juice. "Wanna go over there and check out some bushes?" Ponytail hands off the chalion pipe and stands up without a word. Ed grins approvingly and heads for the garden. The guy catches him around the waist as they step off the lawn, pressing them chest to back and bending down to move Ed's hair aside to kiss his neck. Ed approves highly of this behavior, so he tilts his head and lets it slow them down, doing that awkward, slightly side-to-side walk of two people trying to move four legs. The garden proves to be very much between caretakers as they shuffle further in, but Ed doesn't mind. Between the guy in his black outfit and the branches whacking his legs, it's reminding him of all the times he got bark scrapes on his face from getting railed in the woods by Greedling. They finally hit a fence after ducking through enough growth that the noise of the party is slightly muted, and they aren't at risk of any surprise exhibitionism. The guy stays at his back, nosing his neck and rubbing up his chest, and that feels good enough that Ed doesn't notice they've stepped maybe a little too far into a massive wisteria cluster, where the open ground space does not translate into a lack of branches at face height. Good looking thing, aren't you? Ponytail murmurs, because he's protected from all the twigs by way of them all stabbing into Ed. Yeah, listen, hey, Ed starts, but then he gets distracted when a wisteria branch almost goes up his nose. This lets Ponytail drag his hands around the waistband of Ed's pants, toying with the belt. Then he pauses. Hello? Ponytail says interestedly, plucking at the small of Ed's back. Oh, he's found a knife. What's this? Just leave it. It'll stay with the belt, Ed says distractedly, trying not to inhale petals. Only then Ponytail takes Ed's chin in his hand and turns it to kiss him. So far, Ed hasn't been totally sold on the whole kissing thing. As, like, a practice, if not the concept. He's pretty sure it's not that he's been kissing the wrong people or that they were bad at it or anything, because it seems statistically unlikely that everyone is that bad at it. It's just that it seems like most everybody likes doing stuff that Ed finds, well, gross. Tasting what someone else had for dinner is seriously not what he wants out of mouth contact. Even Winry. They kissed way more on the cheek or neck or tits than the mouth when they were together. But Win did tell him that it was kind of an acquired preference, and, well, she had succeeded in acquiring it. Ed's halfway resigned to having to acquire it, too, because it seems like everyone fucking else boarded that train and isn't getting off anytime soon. Ponytail is no exception, which means Ed gets a mouthful of beer and tobacco. The strong, bitter stuff, not the fruity muscle that's in all the student pipes. At least he doesn't stay on long, moves to Ed's neck again. And between that and the damn bushes and trying not to spill his drink, Ed doesn't have a chance to do his usual introductory demo before Ponytail's hand starts rubbing over his crotch. His cunt isn't exactly a national secret, but it's not information he owes anybody who isn't T-minus 10 seconds from finding out on their own anyway. So he does generally have to introduce the downstairs situation like a realtor revealing a remodeled specialty basement. Ponytail doesn't seem to notice for a moment, just rubbing between Ed's legs, then does a sort of pause and shuffle as his hand goes less exploratory and more seeking for something that isn't there. Ed would take over the general tour at this point, only he's busy fighting off the goddamned vengeance of the wood here, so Ponytail's on his fucking own. This one branch just will not stay wedged out of the way. Ponytail finally pauses. Oh, you're... Yup. Ed grunts, shoving leaves out of his face and widening his stance a bit to give Ponytail's hand more room, because he's a big believer in multitasking. Well, keep going. Shit, Ponytail breathes, sounds appreciative. That's hot. Ed allows it, because Ponytail's bringing his other palm down, and it's good. None of the can I, may I, what are you into shit. Just confident hands getting straight to the point. You're so hot, he repeats. Fuck, that's so hot. You don't have to keep telling me, Ed says, vaguely annoyed, but mostly preoccupied with pushing the one incredibly insistent branch away without actually breaking it. It's not fucking news here. He finally succeeds in trapping it behind other, less aggressive branches, and turns around, briefly knocking Ponytail's hands off. All right, get your dick out. The cock is very promising, at least. Ed fishes a condom out of his back pocket and gets in some good groping as he rolls it on, enjoying the weight in his hand. The guy's definitely the type to try to keep kissing him if they do this face-to-face, though. So Ed pushes his own pants down, turns around and spreads his legs, tossing a grin back over his shoulder. Like this. Yeah, the guy breathes, stepping forward and grabbing Ed's hips again. Yeah, oh fuck yeah. He seems pretty happy to just rub his dick between Ed's cheeks for a bit, though. So Ed takes a swig of his drink, brings his free hand down and pushes his ass back, and fishes around until he gets the correct handful. Cock, hello, meat pussy. Let's go. This is where the estrogen doodad and vaginas in general come in super useful. Being able to make your own lube ain't nothing to sneeze at. Testosterone is a hell of a drug, but not being able to just slide right on in with some friendly rubbing and a push is something Ed is not going to give up. Especially as Ponytail shuffles them closer to the fence and another wisteria branch tries to get friendly, given his entertainment choices. Ed is not enough of a cargo pants person to support a non-self-lubing lifestyle. He braces his hand against the nearest fence post, wiggling back to seat the cock in properly. Ponytail helpfully stabilizes the base, then takes enough of a gulp of his drink to bring the liquid level down from don't sneeze to maybe not immediately spillable. All right, have at it, big guy. What, you're still drinking? The guy laughs. All right, let's see about that. The problem, Ed identifies pretty much immediately, is that the guy has taken him as some kind of penile challenge. It's admittedly the downside of fucking older dudes. Ed has not fallen over himself to slobber his manpole, so now the guy has to show him what for. With his dick. Now, Ed is all about being shown what for. He's absolutely a fan. But generally that sort of thing only works when you can actually back it up. There's certainly a lot of bouncing and jostling going on, but if Ed's main concern is whether the vine climbing up the fence post of his handhold is poison ivy, then maybe the guy's not quite up to the task. Ed should probably do something about it. Fucking standing up gives him shit leverage when he's the one taking it, though, which is a major downside of the position. And especially apparent when it's clear this guy's most helpful contribution would be on his back with his arms by his sides and his dick available for riding. Ed entertains himself for a bit with trying to finish his drink without spilling from the thrusting, but even that only lasts as long as the drink does. He tries to decide whether he even wants to make himself come or not. On the one hand, no orgasm equals no point. So if he doesn't come, then he's just letting Ponytail crash test his ass cheeks for no goddamn reason. On the other hand, he came twice today already, so it's not like he's jonesing. And if he really wants it later, he can take care of it himself. He'd take care of it himself now, only they've got a limited set of options when it comes to switching positions here, and no way Ed's taking his pants all the way off, or getting down on the ground. He's had enough mud in his hair for a lifetime. Maybe if Ponytail traps him up against the fence, grinds his face in it a little. But his eye socket and jaw are still kind of tender from when that rugby guy was knocking his head against the floorboards in the athletic equipment storage room last week. Which, come to think of it, hadn't been very satisfying either. Fuck, is he getting sick of sex? No, that can't be it. He did come with Winry just a couple of hours ago. Win knows how to work him, though. Maybe it's just that these guys aren't working with a full complement of operational intelligence, and Ed isn't invested enough to teach them. It's not, like, bad. The guy's still going at him like Armstrong pounding concrete in a practice quarry, and the friction's fine. It's just fucking repetitive and not gonna make him come. This is disappointing, though. The whole point of getting fucked is that you get fucked. When Greed or Ling felt Ed getting bored, they'd pick him up or force him down on his knees or roll out the carbon armor and make him pay attention. Then, like the guy heard him, there's a sharp tug on Ed's scalp. Ponytail's grabbed himself a fistful of hair. Another downside of fucking strangers, Ed thinks grimly, as he snaps his free hand back around Ponytail's wrist. They don't know what'll get them bit. not the hair, he says aloud, letting both tone and grip indicate he means business. He feels the fingers loosen, hand slowly opening under his hold. His hair slithers back down over his shoulders. All right, man, Ponytail says, sounding almost wary for a second. No harm done. Ed grunts in acknowledgement and pushes back with his hips, indicating that Ponytail should get on with it. After a second, he does, if somewhat slower than before. Which doesn't actually improve anything. Does he have to do everything himself? Typically, Ed likes to reward initiative, but the fact that Ponytail went for his hair first isn't making him inclined to allow extra credit. Why is he even fucking this guy? Okay, he knows why. It's not exactly a fucking mystery. Wait, shit. Does he have a Jingyi's dude fetish? Is this a problem? Ed mentally tallies up the men he's fucked in the past 12 months, finds the Jingyi's percentage, and concludes that, numerically, it may be a problem. Does he need to do something about it? What the hell would fixing that even look like? Some kind of desensitization-related cock and ball torture? Is there even a vagina equivalent for that? He and Winry tried that stuff with the clothespins a couple of times, but he wouldn't exactly call that torture. Or desensitization. He could use a few clothespins here right now, in fact. Also, in potential Jingyi's racial fetish calculations, he should probably account for how 5 of those 12 months he was fucking in Jing. It's definitely skewing the data some. Yeah, okay, he's definitely not coming tonight. He also has a feeling Ponytail is one of those guys who thinks that insisting they be allowed to make their partner come is some kind of chivalry thing. Ed doesn't have all night here, so his options are to fake it or deal with whatever Ponytail decides is the correct response to sexual dissatisfaction. Ed's never faked an orgasm before. Could be fun to try. Though, with his acting skills, it might just make the guy think he needs a Heimlich maneuver. And honestly, it's not hard to make Ed come. Is this guy even trying? He hasn't even reached for Ed's clit once he realizes an outrage, despite the fact that if he had, Ed probably would have knocked his hand away and taken over himself. Very abruptly, everything flips over from tolerable and vaguely annoying to fucking infuriating. And that slice of rage down his spine is Ed's signal to do something before it all hazes out and the only thing he cares about is putting this guy's face through the fence boards in front of him. Right, that's it, Ed says, letting go of the fence, twisting and stepping forward to push Ponytail out of him and knocking him back a step. Ponytail looks taken aback, but when Ed orders, back against the fence, slugging down the dregs of his drink and wedging the cup in the nearest fork of wisteria, he does it. Ed grabs him by the shoulders. Ponytail's breath leaves him in an oof. And after some annoying fucking around with the clothes, pants are great except for when they're stupid. He clamps his legs around Ponytail's hips and pushes himself back onto his cock. Ponytail grunts a punched-out kick of breath against Ed's neck that turns into a gasp as Ed levers himself up again. Ponytail's not strong enough to take Ed's full weight, but that's fine. Ed is, and using the fence as primary leverage works great. Even if Ponytail now sounds like he's being dragged backwards through the bushes, Ed spent all this time guerrilla landscaping. This close, Ed can smell leather and some kind of wood soap under the tobacco. And that's nice. Good enough to counterbalance the general eau de partie. Which is honestly one of the least sexy scents to fuck to, despite being one of the most convenient. There was this one freight worker Ed saw for a couple nights at this bar out in Rowan. And the guy was big enough to just bounce him, which was physically hilarious and gave him the neon edge of thrill that came with, this could really hurt me. Of course, for the entire week after, he'd had weird sex dreams about Darius and Hinkle, vivid enough that he felt he should probably call them up and apologize. But the point is that this position can really work in the right situation, as opposed to just feeling like work. This is not one of those situations. He is, however, probably redeeming himself in the eyes of McKenna, who was not thrilled earlier when she found out he was missing a conditioning practice to pick up Winry. Ed speeds up a bit, clenches down, bares teeth in Ponytail's face, and that does the trick. The guy comes, gruntily, fingers digging into Ed's hips. Afterwards, he seems a bit too inclined to hang out with his face tucked damply into Ed's neck. But given that his biceps aren't anything to write home about, it only takes a casual wiggle for Ed to disengage and hop down without seeming overly eager. Ponytail flicks some hair out of his eyes, breathing ragged, still mostly slumped against the fence. "What's your name?" "Hey, Ed!" "And that's Winry. Thank fuck." "I know you're out here, Ed. Hurry up and come back inside. Landy wants us to show her how to do the double slide." "Gotta go," Ed says brightly, hiking his pants up with a hop and patting briskly at Ponytail's chest. "That was, you know, anyway. Ed! See ya!" Ed slithers out of the bushes and makes for the deck, determinedly not allowing the general disarray of his briefs to hinder his stride as he slips past Winry, with her hands on her hips and a crossly expectant look on her face. "Ed! Bathroom!" Ed returns, and pounds upstairs to find one that won't have a line of 10 people deep. 5 minutes later, he's back downstairs, as cleaned up as a communal horsehouse bathroom sink can get him, which is clearly 5 minutes more than Wynne would have liked, but she just wrinkles her nose at him in routine judgment of his sexual inadvisability, and marches him to the main room. "This is a little slow," Wynne says, circling a finger in the air and snapping at the pilfered loudspeaker as Ed starts pushing chairs off to the side with his foot. "Hey, Brett, turn on something more. You got the Blackwell band?" Brett, or a compatriot, bull roars an affirmative, followed shortly by two left feet starting to blare somewhat honkily over the speaker. It's the fastest song on the album, and thus Winry's favorite, which means Ed's about to get a full fucking workout in the span of 2:40, and is frankly fucking ideal. Maybe he should stop just fucking people, he thinks, as he steps onto the floor and Wynne immediately drops back into his arm, knowing he'll catch her, anchoring automatically over his left shoulder because she knows his right is still temperamental. Maybe he should try the dating shit for real. Figure out what he wants to do with Full Metal, whether to bring him out of limbo or bury him for keeps. Decide whether he wants to stick with the civil engineering shit or, hell, just fuck off to Creta after university. If he wants to get a degree at all. Well, he'll see. He's got time. Nothing but time. Nothing but whatever he wants for the rest of his life. Hooray!